Welcome to the panel, RNZ National. Someone says, we learnt to make bread during lockdown and now we still churn out 2 to 4 loaves a week. I just purchased a deli slicer today as I learned to make prosciutto during lockdown and it's finally ready to eat. Making bacon is next and we are signed up for cheese making classes and sausage making classes. Lockdown has taught us to try new things. Thanks for that text. Well, today, as more countries open their borders, the future of New Zealand's global connectivity is a growing concern. And a man with COVID-19 left managed isolation in Auckland for more than an hour and he went to a supermarket in the central CBD. We discussed with Professor Michael Plank. Social media giants are not cooperating with China's new security laws being imposed on Hong Kong. Media giant TikTok will exit the country. Jack Yan, who is from Hong Kong on the show today, and business mentor Sarah Tropman believes a lot of businesses will fail without extra support. Today I'm with Catherine Robinson, novelist, reviewer and writer, and Phil O'Reilly, global business leader and advocate, managing director of Iron Duke Partners. But first, yesterday evening around 5:30pm, National MP Hamish Walker released a statement confirming that he had passed details of COVID-19 patients to media. And around 10 minutes later, acting chief executive of Auckland Rescue Helicopter Trust, Michelle Bogue, confirmed she gave the details to Walker. Michelle Bogue, of course, was on the panel half an hour before the news broke. By the way, Michelle Bogue, around the country, the whole country is listening to you emailing. They think it's me. I'm just letting you. Right. You can keep going. Who the heck are you emailing?
It's very important.
Right. Okay. Michelle Bogue has resigned from her campaign and electorate roles for Auckland Central MP and National Deputy Leader Nikki Kaye. The Auckland Rescue Helicopter Trust has confirmed that Michelle Bogue has resigned as acting CEO and trustee. And Hamish Walker announced today he won't be standing for re-election for the Southland electorate at the election. Todd Muller has accepted his decision. And as I mentioned, we phoned Michelle Bogue to come onto the panel to explain her actions. She declined. With us is lawyer Graham Edgster. Welcome, Graham.
Thank you for having me on, Wallace.
What do you make of this story and appalling lack of judgment, says Todd Muller? Is that what you call it?
Yes, I think, these sorts of highly personal, highly sensitive medical records are not things that people should be wantonly emailing around to people without, you know, without a good reason, and I'm not sure that there could be a good reason. So, bad show all around, to be honest.
Can you speculate on what Michelle Bogue hoped to achieve by leaking the information to Walker? And where did you get that information from, do you reckon?
Well, I have no idea what was hoped to be achieved. The speculation, you know, try to embarrass the government. You know, I can't think of how, but, you know, if you're a former National Party, you know, president and, you know, long-time National Party operative, that presumably something political, but exactly what, I do not know. Where she got it, that's the next question, you know. I mean, political scandals don't usually happen this quickly. You know, the political part of this is over. The person who leaked it to the MP has resigned from the roles that she got it in and has resigned from various roles she had in the political party. The MP has announced he's not going to be standing at the next election in less than 3 months. Yeah, that bit's over. So, you know, it's what happens next. You know, there's sort of the political bit's over. It's the legal bits which come next.
And, so to that, in what
the question of where Michelle Bogue got the information from is one I think we need the answer for, because I can't see why she would have needed it, even as the acting CEO of a you know, hospital helicopter organisation.
Well, on that, I mean, the Auckland Rescue Helicopter Trust says Michelle Bogue had no access to COVID-19 patient data. What does this change, if any?
It potentially changes who might be successfully sued. You know, the people whose sort of personal medical information has been leaked to various people, potentially Michelle Bogue, and then further on to various members of the media and things like that, they potentially, I think, have a claim under the Privacy Act for a breach of their privacy rights. You know, whom do they sue is the question. And if it's not the Auckland Regional Helicopter Trust, then it might be someone else. But that, I think, is, you know, if they're concerned about it, that is something they could very well seek to get a remedy for.
What actions should be taken now, Graham? I mean, what are the consequences? As I understand, an MP is not subject to the Privacy Act. Is that right?
There are... as an MP, certainly there are some limits on you know, what they have to do and can't do and are allowed to do. There are other possibilities for the MP involved. It could be a breach of confidence or just a privacy tort. You know, so not just the legislation, there's also other breaches of privacy. You'll remember Winston Peters had a privacy claim. Had a decision a few months back about the release of sensitive information about his tax and welfare affairs with his entitlement or not to a certain level of retirement benefit. He sued under the privacy tort.
Right.
Unsuccessful, but that is another possibility. I would have thought his claim would have been better under the Privacy Act, but he, I think, had a reasonable go at it. And so there are other possibilities. Privacy Act, I think, seems the simplest one. And, you know, it's a question of, you know, was this information properly protected by those who ought to have been protecting it? Does the Auckland Regional, you know, they say, they at least, or they say Michelle Bogue didn't have access to it, whether the trust itself had access to it. You know, these aren't, you know, these aren't even their patients. These are potential patients who might need to be sort of moved around the country or something like that. I could see why, yes, you're a pilot and, you know, the doctor who may be on the flight or something like that might need to know who you're picking up today. I can't see why they need to know the name of every case in the country, you know, until it's actually involved them.
We'll bring our guests in very, very shortly, Graham, you can stay on the line, but I just want one more question. So the new Privacy Act has just been passed but has not come into effect yet. Would that have made any difference in this instance?
Not a great deal of difference. You know, it's going to be a breach under the old Act, I think, and probably a breach under the new one. It might have made the process of how you make the claim different. It gives the Privacy Commissioner more powers, and so it potentially could have made the process a little simpler for the initial stages of the claim, where the Privacy Commissioner can actually sort of make, you know, here's the amount I'm going to order you to pay kind of thing. So that type of part of the process. But, you know, I can't see how this isn't a breach of the current one or the new one, which comes into effect in December. So it's not going to change who's liable. It might change the process and potentially what should happen next, because you know, what has happened to these people has happened. But I think what the more important thing now is what's going to happen to equivalent personal information about other COVID people with COVID-19. What's going to happen to their information in the future, and do changes need to be made to ensure something like this can't happen again?
The Privacy Act applies to agencies, not individuals, said the Privacy Commissioner.
An individual can be an agency. So that doesn't necessarily you know, have a problem.
Right.
And if someone was acting as the CEO of an agency, whether the agency knew it or not, you know, there's I think, possible claims. But the fact that someone's an individual does not exclude them from the Privacy Act. It's just sort of personal matters, you know.
Hey, Graham, nice to have you on.
An individual can be, yes.
Yeah, no, I appreciate your time and thank you very much for being with us. That's lawyer Graham Edgler on an issue that I'm sure there'll be more to come on that. Just briefly around the panel, is this dirty politics? Catherine, what do you think?
Well, how can it be anything else, quite frankly? I think, you know, Graham was quite right in saying that the only motive for sharing it has got to be to try and humiliate the government. And when you're doing that, when you know you absolutely should not be sharing this private information, then that is unethical, possibly immoral, and let's hope it's actually illegal as well and some legal redress is made.
Phil?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I realise I'm getting old these days when I start shouting at the television, and I did that last night. I thought it was just despicable what happened there, just absolutely, unbelievably despicable. This person's a member of parliament trying to serve New Zealand's interests in theory, serving only his own, and it was absolutely right that he's gone by lunchtime, absolutely right, and I hope the full force of the law and anything else, and of public opprobrium and all the rest, falls on his ears and that of Michelle Beau. Right. Just astonishing.
Speaking of which, we have had a huge amount of feedback about Michelle Beau being on the panel. Just here's a couple briefly. Cynthia says, I'm a fairly regular listener to your program and understand that you and your producers invite a variety of people to express their views each week. Each weekday, I sincerely hope that after the revelations last evening by Bogue about her disclosure, that she will not appear on any future edition of the panel. By her behaviour, she has disqualified herself as a person whose views can be seriously considered. That's Cynthia's view. Barry says, I'm a regular listener. I enjoy listening to the panel and the different panellists. While I may not always agree, I do like listening to different opinions. But I wonder if it is possible for you to provide me with any advance warning of when Michelle Bogue is scheduled to be on air so I may turn my radio off. So, look, just to let you know, listeners, that Michelle Bogue will not be appearing on the panel anytime soon, that I can tell you this afternoon. It's 18 past four, the panel. There are calls for businesses to be able to still get a wage subsidy if they can make a sound business case to continue getting the support. The Prime Minister has announced the wage subsidy will come to an end on September the 1st. That means there will no longer be $585.50 per week for each full-time employee paid to businesses which suffered a 40% loss in a month due to COVID-19. The nearly $12 billion scheme has been in place since March. Business mentor Sarah Troppen believes a lot will fail without that support, and there should still be instances where it is still available. Sarah, welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks, Wallace.
Let's start with what you think will happen once a business can't access that subsidy.
Well, I think we all need to accept, of course, this is a sort of one in 100 years economic shock, and there absolutely will be another significant spike in unemployment. And really what we're doing at Business Mentors New Zealand is encouraging business to be bold, move quickly, and actually be realistic about what the future looks like for themselves.
What sort of stories are you hearing at Business Mentors?
Well, the reason why I came out and said we'd like to see certain sectors continue to be supported with the wage subsidy is there are different sectors, and actually the focus needs to be on export businesses, of course. They're the businesses that are generating the wealth for the country, and so we need to turn our attention towards them. And that's more than just tourism businesses. It's businesses that are providing products and services offshore. And of course, they bring the value of those contracts back to Aotearoa New Zealand.
So the idea is that this should be on a case-by-case basis where a business can put forward a case as to why they should be getting a continued subsidy. What might that benchmark be?
Look, I'm not sure that it should be actually a case-by-case basis, but it should be across certain sectors or with a general focus on any business that has actually generated export revenues in the last 12 months or the last 2 years. Because remember, it's incredibly expensive preparing yourself for entering into new markets, and often it's the staff themselves that have that competency and that knowledge that the business owner has invested a huge amount in. Now, if those staff are made redundant because the wage subsidy stops, that's a huge resource that the business is actually losing.
So you're clearly concerned about this wage subsidy ending on September the 1st. You fear what, the worst?
I'm concerned about it ending for some businesses. I absolutely agree that we cannot have businesses accepting a wage subsidy and sitting back and thinking the government's actually going to solve all of their problems. Business owners do need to take full responsibility for the success or failure of their business. But my point is that I think there are certain businesses that do need to be supported because they are the ones generating the wealth for our country.
Right, yeah. Because I'm just going to say that the Prime Minister has said, hasn't she, that a continued wage subsidy would delay the critical work that businesses may need to do to pivot in the new COVID environment.
And I agree with her there. As an organisation ourselves, of course, we haven't needed a wage subsidy because we've had an increase of by 700% of businesses that are reaching out for business mentoring at the moment. What the wage subsidy has allowed organisations like us to do is actually prepare ourselves for that dramatic increase of business support that is required. And there are a number of different options that the government can now turn their attention to now that we've lived with COVID for a number of months. And I'd like to see these business panels, I'd like to hear from these business panels. The Prime Minister and other government agencies will have rallied thoughts from experts, including trade and sector associations who probably need increased financial support. But there'll be other aspects that will be considered for support of business, and we need to be hearing about those. Business owners do take responsibility themselves, but they need some guidance. They need that macro picture set. For example, the framework behind the strategy of opening up the borders. They need something to plan towards.
Right. Business mentor Sarah Tropman, thank you very much for your time.
You're so welcome.
Phil, you've got to rip the plaster off sometime. Simply be the first it is.
Exactly. I feel for these business people. It's just no fault of their own. They're disastrous. They might lose their house. They might lose employees they've employed for decades. I feel for them. The problem, though, is that if a business has been moribund for the last 20 weeks, it's dead. It is moribund. And the world is changing around us. The tourism sector will not be the same when people start coming back here. Export markets are changing. So if you're going to try and say New Zealand businesses should just stay exactly as they were the day we moved into lockdown, that will be disastrous. And in fact, all around the world, the OECD economies are all doing the same thing as we should be doing, which is moving from these kind of support packages into what's the next normal. And that doesn't mean government shouldn't support businesses, but what it shouldn't do is effectively have two unemployment benefits operating in the economy. The unemployment benefit for a company that you happen to be working for if you went into lockdown, or the normal one. What we should be doing is saying, right, there's a decision made, it's all over, and we get capital reallocated and employees into new jobs, and that is now the challenge. And regrettably, government's doing very little about that, and the opposition's not saying much either.
Catherine, your thoughts?
Well, I don't know about this sort of... doing it on a case-by-case basis, I think potentially... Phil's shaking his head terribly. But I can see that there are, you know, the things like the supply chain, and not just about export businesses, but also about, you know, businesses here, particularly retail, that rely on goods being shipped from overseas, where wait times are considerably delayed and some things aren't even available. Now, I think, you know, I do kind of agree that what Phil said about, you know, if business is dead by now, then it is probably dead forever. But businesses should be looking perhaps at... there's the loans from the IRD out there, the loans from the government, sort of low to nothing interest. And looking at what they can do to mitigate some of those risks. But I'm still sort of in favour of some governmental support for businesses that are finding things, you know, they're doing everything they can, but the world is conspiring against them.
Okay. 25 past four, you're on the panel, RNZ National, with me today, Catherine Robinson and Phil O'Reilly. Well, as more countries open their borders, the future of New Zealand's global connectivity is a growing concern. When is the right time in the age of a pandemic to open up? Who with and to what extent? And how do we evaluate trade-offs? With us to discuss is Professor Michael Plank at Te Pūnaha Matatini and the University of Canterbury. Professor Plank, welcome to the program.
Kia ora.
Can I just first jump into the news actually out today? I just want to get your thoughts on it because a lot of people are talking about it. Today, a man with COVID-19 left managed isolation in Auckland for more than an hour, goes to a supermarket, Victoria Street West. That supermarket's closed down, the staff are away. What sort of concern is that?
Well, it's really disappointing that people are breaking rules, deviating from pretty clear expectations to do that sort of thing. I mean, the risk from being out of quarantine for an hour is probably pretty small, but nevertheless, really disappointing that people would take that sort of attitude.
Yeah. You say that, look, if we want to open our borders, we will just have to accept that the risk will increase. Can you explain that a bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the travel numbers, so at the moment we're getting about 400 arrivals a day on average, and we're seeing about 12 cases per week at the border. And with those sorts of numbers, we're confident we can manage those cases and catch them in the 14-day quarantine. Before COVID, in a typical day, we might see about 20 or 25,000 arrivals per day. And if you do the math, that could mean 600 or 700 cases a week. And there's no way you'd be able to, obviously, keep that number of people in quarantine. So what that shows is a return to business as usual really isn't an option at the moment. So we need to think about what ways we can start to enable some travel safely. But going back to those pre-COVID numbers is just not an option.
It's a tricky one, eh? 600 to 700 cases a week. Imagine that. I mean, how could we cope? But look, this is what Sir Peter Gluckman said, Michael. It is unrealistic to imagine that there'll never be cases of COVID in New Zealand. It's just logically inevitable. Went on to say that the vaccine's a long way off and we can't sit here forever without thinking about the future. What do you think?
Well, it's true that cases are inevitable, but that doesn't mean we should just open up and accept hundreds of them. What we need to do is to find a balance that keeps those cases to a minimum and to a level where we can manage them and keep them in quarantine or based on a travel bubble with other countries that have eliminated the virus. So it really needs to be based on the risk of who you're opening travel up to.
Professor Michael Plank, thank you very much for joining us on the program. Well, what do you actually go into this news about this gentleman, Catherine, who left managed isolation and went for more than an hour. This is my local supermarket, actually, but haven't been there for a week or so.
I'd just like
to point out. But look, a lot of people on social media are saying, throw the book at him. This is the person who is endangering our society. What do you reckon?
Well, yeah, I sort of have fantasies, you know, the slightly murderous fantasies of putting his single-use plastic bag over his head. But, of course, that's not a rational response at all. But he broke the law. So there should be some punishment for that, whatever it is legally under our law.
What do you think, Phil?
Oh, yeah, and no doubt he will be punished. As I've seen some reports about that today, the wider issue, though, is this weird debate that we seem to have that the border either remains almost completely closed or somehow we're just going to open it up altogether. And that's not what Peter Gluckman, Helen Clark and Rob Fife talked about in their report. They said, how can we start to open it up? And if you look at other countries around the world, Taiwan, for example, you're seeing they are starting to open their borders to people who are well, and we should be thinking about how we can achieve that outcome through testing, contact tracing and so on. So it's a really null debate to say either if nobody crossed the border or we're just open slather. Well, nobody's arguing for open slather. What we should be doing is having a much more active debate about how we can get people through who might be well and might actually contribute to New Zealand's economic success and income and social success and community success. That's really the debate.
It's a bit like the rabies thing for animals, you know. You can quarantine your animal if it comes from a non-rabies country and you can get a free pass of it if it is. Yeah.
We did a straw poll, very unscientific, but 95% of people did not want us to open our borders on the panel yesterday. But look, some people suggested we can't stay shut off from the world forever or
Precisely.
Wait for a vaccine, Catherine.
Taiwan and Iceland are nice places. We should invite them over and we can go there.
Okay, those two, yep. All right. 29, yep.
So we just need to have a more sophisticated debate about this, Wallace. I mean, I'm one of the 97. If you say, let's not go back to what we were doing just before lockdown, of course not. But we do need to think about how we can get business people out of New Zealand to sell things into world markets. And we do need to think about how we can get people to come here, not just as tourists, not even as tourists, but as people who can contribute to our success, because we need them. We always have.
Okay. I'm trying to organise my husband's significant birthday for the end of the year in December, and it's going to be quite a short guest list if we can't get some of our friends from overseas.
Zoom.
Yeah.
Well,